Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of November. It's all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 9. Our guest this hour has had a particular interest in the Occupy Wall Street movement, which we will talk about this hour. There is also much news internationally. What's going on in Greece? Today we hear news about Italy. How do we bring down this unemployment rate in the United States? We've been asking this question for months now. Will there be any kind of jobs bill passed anytime soon? It's going to be a year from now. We will have had an election. That's hard to believe. It's a year from now. That goes by. Whip, lickety split. We will have voted for a new president of the United States or to retain the president of the United States we have now. So we will look at that race and a number of other issues as well. Professor David Green is associate professor of political science. He studied at Madison for his PhD, and that was in comparative politics. He teaches in the subfields of comparative politics, international relations, and American politics, including courses related to European integration, political identity, and comparative mass behavior. He's published articles on UN peacekeeping and trends in political identification, and he teaches at Hofstra University. Our phone number for you to join All Things Political is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He wrote in a piece recently, "The most astonishing and depressing aspect of our era or perhaps has been the fact that at the very time when conditions are such that one could almost not possibly write a script more favorable to the rise of a robust left in the country, precisely the opposite has been happening. What left there is left in the country has been moribund, its heartbeat barely detectable. Meanwhile, what's described as the left operating under the banner of the Democratic Party has shown itself every bit as capable of whoring for capital as the other party, though it swims even deeper in the cesspool of treason by pretending that it is the party of the people." He has been heartened by what's been happening with Occupy Wall Street. We'll talk about that and a number of other issues. And welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Green, hello. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Hey, Kathleen. Yeah. Good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So you've said in some recent pieces you have allowed yourself to once again risk being hopeful.
A little bit.
Why is that?
Well, maybe the first question is why would I not be hopeful? Because I guess, in terms of personal constitution, I'm a fairly hopeful and upbeat person. And I've been a believer in the idea of American democracy pretty much all my life. But recent events have made me very much less hopeful. And I think, there are several things I would point to. I mean, I think the last decade has been pretty much, I don't think you should mince words here. I think it's been pretty much catastrophic for the hope of, the American experiment with democracy and a certain system of political economy and so on. And then I think really the capstone on that has been the Obama presidency, in which many people, much more so than I, but I as well, invested hope in this president, invested belief in his campaign rhetoric in 2008. And particularly a lot of young people. I think most of us have been sorely disappointed, I think, by any realistic measure. This presidency is a failure, and the state of the country is worse off than it was prior to Obama assuming the presidency. His crimes are crimes more of omission than commission, but nevertheless, I mean, he governs at a time of multiple crises, and he promised bold solutions to those crises, and he has not delivered. And there are also, I would say, crimes of commission as well. In any case, if you roll it all together, I think it breeds a certain degree of pessimism as to whether the American political system can continue to deliver as it has over, more or less, over with a bit of a rocky road here and there, over two-plus centuries. What makes me a little bit more hopeful right now is that I think people are beginning to wake up to that. Occupy Wall Street is probably the major part of the reason why I feel a little bit more hopeful. Tomorrow we'll see a ballot resolution in Ohio, an attempt to reject union-busting efforts by the Republican right in that state. You see more and more consciousness, I think. I mean, the spate of articles, just by that measure alone, which have been written in the last, I'd say, 6 months, maybe even 3 months, on the matter of concentration of wealth in America, and on the matter of the way our political system fails to represent the interests of the American people, is vastly greater than anything that I've seen over the last 30 years, which is the time period in which this whole process of concentration of wealth and the hijacking of this political system has been transpiring. So anyhow, for those reasons, I have I've had a little bit of hope restored to my my political soul.
And yet you say, and I'm wondering how all of this will play into the elections, if we might indeed see some kind of third-party candidate, or we'll see the president shift dramatically to the left on certain kind of issues. You say no matter who the people are in 2013, and we know who they are pretty much now, they will all be cut from the same cloth. What is the cloth?
It's the plutocratic cloth. You know, I don't think Barack Obama, who's supposedly the candidate of the left, I mean, if you listen to conservatives, and even that word I think is a misnomer, but let's just use it, that's what they call themselves. If you listen to conservatives, they will describe him as some far-left European socialist monster. So that is the candidate of the left, right, for what it's worth in America. That will be the presidential candidate of the left. To my mind, from what I can see and from what I can observe from, you know, empirical observation, Obama's interests are primarily the interests of the oligarchy and Wall Street in particular, but others as well. And he's served those interests well. And if you look at the people that he's appointed to staff his administration, you know, they're sort of right out of the same playbook. Many of them come from Wall Street. Many of them are personally responsible for the economic crisis that we find themselves in, which is a crisis driven almost entirely by rampant greed. And then you ask yourself, what has he done for the other, 99%, as the phrase goes? Here he is 3 years into his administration, and he's finally decided, oh, we better have a jobs bill. Seems to me that the one job that he's particularly worried about right now is his own. And for 3 years, he's kind of done nothing about the fact that unemployment has skyrocketed in the United States. And amongst us out here in the 99%, everybody is suffering. But the rich are richer than ever. Yes, there are marginal differences. I would say especially on social policy, less so on economic policy, less so on foreign policy. There are marginal differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. But at the end of the day, I think that Obama and his primary commitments are the same as those of virtually all political actors in Washington, virtually all those on the horizon, and certainly all the mainstream presidential candidates who might be inaugurated on January 20th, 2013.
We've been talking about jobs and talking about jobs and talking about jobs for months now. It is flabbergasting to me that the Democrats and the Republicans don't understand what's going on in Wisconsin or Ohio or in every state of the country in terms of really high unemployment, and as you said, people are suffering. No wonder nobody's happy with anything that anybody's doing in Washington. Why can't they address a fundamental need of the American people to go to work?
If I could just say, Kathleen, I think you do them a service unfairly by saying that they don't understand the problem. I think they understand the problem quite well. I think the question is, what are their commitments? Who do they serve? What are their political commitments? And their political commitments are not to us. I mean, I think we just have to, if we really want to fix America, we really have to have a sobering little conversation with ourselves, and we have to understand, and I think increasingly Americans are understanding this, though I don't think they really really understand the sheer depth of this question, but we have to understand that our political system has been hijacked and that the political system is owned by special interests, and it does not serve the American people's interests. So if it's not in the interest of economic elites that, you know, 9% unemployment come down to 4%, then it's just not going to happen as long as the people making policy are responsive to the 1% or the 0.1% rather than to the 99%. And, you know, people can reject that thesis if they want, and they can dismiss me as some sort of left-wing kook. I don't particularly think I'm either left-wing, you know, certainly not in a dogmatic sense, and I like to think I'm not a kook. But I hope that a lot of your listeners, for example, and this is just, you know, one example that I could give, but certainly a very prominent one. I hope a lot of your listeners happened to see 60 Minutes last night, where Jack Abramoff, who was, you know, really unrivaled as a player in this game, talked about owning members of Congress. And that is the word he used. He said, "I owned about 100 members of Congress." And he talked, the word that he also used, again, these are his words, not mine, to describe the overall architecture of the American political system in Washington is bribery. Now, if Jack Abramoff is saying that, and I'm saying, I hope people will understand that, you know, I mean, that is just simply an empirical fact of the way it works. And that's why our problems are not being addressed, because those who make policy don't have any incentive to address the problems of the people. They have every incentive to address the problems of their benefactors.
So what do all of these Occupy movements all over the world really, what's the impact they have on the people who do make policy? Is it minuscule? Is it nothing? Do they ignore them?
I would say at this point it's almost nothing. You know, these are nascent movements or a nascent movement, which, you know, can go any one of myriad directions. It could be crushed overnight. People could be pushed out of Zuccotti Park, for example, or other locations and not return. They could be pushed out, and that could precipitate a mass outpouring of other people to come down, and that could have the unintentional consequence of amplifying the movement. The movement could fade away because of the cold of winter or lack of sustainability. It could fade away because it's chosen to be leaderless and it has chosen not to articulate a sort of, you know, hard and fast set of principles. I mean, the possibilities are endless, and I'm no more able to predict them than anybody else. In the same fashion that who would have predicted, you know, 2 years ago the events that have transpired in various Middle Eastern countries? Who would have predicted the end of the Mubarak regime in Egypt? I mean, I don't think you can see that coming. I don't think you can see in Tunisia that, you know, one man's suicide will be the spark that will precipitate the overthrow of a long corrupt regime. But I'm hopeful about it because it's the closest thing that we've had in 30 years, I think, to an understanding that the system is rigged and a willingness on the part of people to sort of stand up and say that, you know, basta, enough. That's not okay anymore. And I'm gonna sit here in the streets in order to make that known.
What happened to the democratic fervor in Egypt? We have to do a show on that again to find out what's going on. My understanding is that the military is pretty much in control. What happened?
Well, that's my understanding too. I'm certainly not an expert in that area, but I guess I would only counsel that it's really difficult to sustain a movement like this. I mean, people have to have the energy, they have to have the time, they have to have the willingness sometimes to be beaten over the head, even sometimes to be killed, to be harassed. You know, it's very easy to crush something like this. It's very easy for it to be crushed before it's even born by nature of the fact that it's just a really difficult thing. I mean, listeners to your show should just ask themselves, you know, suppose you felt committed to this or that question, how much time would you be willing to devote? Would you be willing to go in, you know, and camp in some park and stay there over the winter? I mean, most, you know, by far and away, most people cannot and will not do that. So it's possible what happened in Egypt is simply that the movement has run out of steam, or it's also possible that the final chapter hasn't been written there. It may vary, and I would say the same thing about Iran, right? Iran rose up a couple years back. I don't necessarily think that, and that movement was crushed, I don't necessarily think that story is over. I think it, you know, may be in abeyance at this point, and the people of Egypt may come to say, you know, well, this isn't what we rose up for, you know, to have a military, despotic government instead of a non-military despotic government, and so they may have to go back out on the streets in order to reclaim the democracy that they fought for.
And before we go to phone calls, you mentioned Ohio and the vote tomorrow. Which way is the wind blowing in Ohio?
The last I saw, and I'm not sure if this is reliable or not, I haven't seen much data on this, but and this is a little tricky. I gather voting no is a vote to repeal Governor Kasich's union-busting bill. So the last I saw, the no vote was up, predicted to be up 25% according to polling. So if that's accurate, you know, and even given a wide margin of error there, it sounds like that may be a very large victory for progressive forces in Ohio.
Two phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Professor David Green. He's a professor of political science at Hofstra University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Greg in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, thanks for taking this call. Morning, Professor Green.
Morning.
I just want to make a, you know, I deliver to manufacturing facilities all over America, and there's a large number of Latinos that work these facilities. Just making that comment. Also, I feel about the Occupy Wall Street demonstrators. I think, you know, I come originally from San Jose, California, and as a child, I saw the during the hippie movement. All those hippies, they grew up to become lawyers and financial people and, you know, very wealthy individuals. So my feeling about the Occupy Wall Street people, if they're not protesting Wall Street, they just want a piece of the pie. And I don't think that even if we got the dissidents out of America, I don't think the Occupy Wall Street movement people would take those jobs. And I'll take your comments off the air, and thanks again.
Well, you know, I'm not sure what the caller's evidence is based on, and I don't have evidence to the contrary. I haven't seen survey data. I've been to Zuccotti Park, but I haven't particularly interviewed people there. I would imagine there's a large variety of people there with a large variety of motivations, probably many people with multiple motivations. I do object to, and I remember this from the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, a kind of disparaging of people. I think many of them are tremendously sincere, and many of them are making huge sacrifices in order to be there, and in fact are sacrificing on behalf of the other members of the 99%. You know, we're talking about 300 million people who are essentially voiceless, as far as I can determine, in policymaking, and these are people trying to speak for them and speak to their benefit. And the other thing I will say is that, and the other place I think the caller may be going astray is that if you look at the opportunities facing young people today, it's a dismal visage. I mean, I would not want to be 25 years old and, you know, on the job market with my freshly minted bachelor's degree in my back pocket right now. It's a terrible time. Most of those people are coming out of school with vastly more debt than they ever had. The job opportunities are not there. And the perception, and I think accurately so, the perception is that the system is rigged and it's rigged against them. And if people are angry about that, my only comment would be they should have been a lot angrier a lot earlier, because this has been going on for a long time. And the only way that we're going to solve this problem is to take back America from the oligarchs who own it at this point.
Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Well, first off, in terms of sustainability, it seems to me it's complicated, but it's also simple. And the core value has to be that I'm going to come at them for the rest of my life and do the best I can and to ask myself a Socratic question, what can I do today to fight them? And there was a book called Let's Get the Party Started, which stated various views of various Democrats on progressive efforts to win. And, of course, they point out that the Republicans or Republican voters a lot of times, even though they at some level they know that the Democrats have a better economic plan, they ignore it because they're diverted by other issues, especially valued issues. And Bill Maher has spoken about this fog that the people are in where they just deny that what is is. And so it seems to me that one underperformed area and ignored area by Democrats is democratic moral values. For example, and a good example of this is Cardinal Bernardin, from the late Cardinal Bernardin from the Catholic Church, talked about the seamless garment, the protection of life from conception to death. And a lot of democratic values actually fit with that. Most of us would not prefer that a woman not have an abortion if possible. We might support her choice to decide whether she would have an abortion, but we prefer to avoid the abortion. And so there are many things that we would support. We would support contraception so that, in contrast to the Republicans, which would prevent the possibility of an abortion coming up in the first place, we would support stem cell research, which we think supports life, control of pollution, limiting guns, limiting needless wars. And so all of these things are supportive of life and represent our moral values. But we don't proclaim to the Republicans that we have moral values and that our moral values are well worth considering. And we've got to work harder on this issue.
Well, I quite agree, although I guess I would say that, you know, the environmental issues and the economic issues are the ones with the fiercest urgency in our particular time. I think we've actually made quite a substantial amount of progress on the social issues and the civil rights issues. Not that we can't do more. We must do more, particularly in the area of gay rights. And not that some of those achievements aren't under assault, particularly in the area of reproductive choice, which they are, in fact. But it seems to me the great urgency right now is more to do with economic questions and great environmental issues that are looming out there. But I think the caller is absolutely correct that the Democratic Party has been weak on this, but the Democratic Party is weak on everything. I mean, I haven't a single positive word to say about the Democratic Party or virtually any Democrat in Congress or in Washington. And actually, once again, I think to say that they're weak is to be overly generous. I mean, I think in reality, their bread is being buttered in the same place as the Republicans. They just have a different history that allows them to kind of glide forward on the basis of those past perceptions going all the way back to FDR. And they have a different sort of persona that they present to the public. But, you know, I mean, if you think about the times when the Democrats have actually been in control, like the first year of the Obama administration, or back in 2006 when they, you know, won a crushing victory and took control of Congress, and you ask yourself, well, what have they done with that power? The answer is essentially nothing. The answer is to essentially continue the policies of the Bush administration, which fundamentally were the same as the Clinton administration, which fundamentally were the same as the Reagan administration, particularly in the areas of political economy.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. We go to Scott in River Falls. Hi, Scott.
Well, good morning. I heard a quote recently that really sums it up for me, and that is, if God had wanted me to vote, he would have given me candidates, and I don't see any out there. I was a huge Obama supporter in terms of time and money and effort, and I feel betrayed by him. But my question is, you know, with respect to what the people can do, can't we do things like withhold our labor, have general strikes, boycott corporations and not buy their stuff, surround the Capitol again? You know, the people came out to support the workers in Wisconsin, the state workers. Well, now where are the state workers to come out and support the Occupy movement? I think civil disobedience and withholding our labor, you know, people refusing to go fight in wars, taking our own power back rather than handing it over to politicians who talk out of two sides of their mouth. And I just wanted to get your guest's thoughts on that.
Thanks, Scott.
I think the caller's absolutely right. I mean, I think that may very well be the way forward. It's not the way forward of my choice. I would much rather see this resolved in, you know, the conventional arena, which I think under normal circumstances is not a bad structure for making political decisions. But because of the attributes that I mentioned earlier, that conventional arena essentially has been hijacked and become, to use Jack Abramoff's term, an arena for bribery. And what that means then is electoral politics may not be an avenue for solving problems anymore. And this is where, as I alluded to earlier, the Obama presidency has been such a disappointment because, like the caller, many, many people really believed in this man, really believed that he would fight for the American public, particularly after 8 years of, you know, Bush-Cheney. And he really just absolutely has not. And so that, you know, when you don't have that conventional forum in which to articulate your politics and get a hearing for them and to win on the basis of what's in the public interest, then you resort to other things. And you're starting to see that. There was a general strike which shut down the port of Oakland in the wake of events there concerning an Occupy movement in Oakland, California. And you're starting to see other things that I think are beginning to kind of take that flavor of people demanding their rights on the streets because they feel very much like there are no electoral alternatives through means of conventional politics.
Let's spend a few moments, because it is a year from now we will be voting again for the presidency with the Republicans. I'm interested in your take on Herman Cain and all these sexual harassment charges, and he's become a little testy with reporters, which is an understatement, over the last couple days, saying he won't deal with these charges. A couple questions. Why is he really caught fire among a lot of people? Do you think he will be brought down by these charges? Do you think that Mitt Romney will ultimately be the candidate, and that he will give the president a run for his money?
Lots of questions there. Herman Cain is an interesting phenomenon. I think I understand him in his present moment less than I understand his rise, but I guess the rise and the attraction for Republican voters is that, you know, he's sort of very plain spoken, and he's a black man who's very plain spoken, and I think maybe he addresses certain, you know, psychological and emotional needs among that voting cohort. But what you're seeing now, when these accusations have surfaced about the sexual harassment cases, I think there are three of them that we know of at this point, and the reaction to that and the blaming the media, I mean, that's right out of sort of Sarah Palin's playbook, and that's kind of, I think that represents a whole kind of besieged mentality amongst that cohort of, I don't know, not to characterize them too much by demographics, but, you know, sort of older, white, probably Southern, Christian, conservative voters who essentially feel like, I think, modernity is destroying everything that they hold valuable and that they're under siege, and they like sort of very plain verities that they can rely upon. And they like to blame the media. So, you know, it's a particularly interesting in this case because, as far as I can see, the media has done nothing but report in this particular instance. And, you know, the question I would like to ask these people like Rush Limbaugh and the voters who are still supporting Cain at the exact same numbers that they were before is, when you blame the media, what is it you want them to do? Do you not want to know that your presidential candidate has been accused of sexual harassment three times in the past? I mean, you simply do not want to know that. Otherwise, why are you screaming at the media? And I think the simple answer to that is because they don't like what's being said, not the fact that it's being said, even though they can't quite say that. In terms of the presidential race, Romney seems to be the prohibitive favorite for the Republican nomination. I think it's too early to dismiss Rick Perry. He's certainly stumbled in the debates, but he's got a lot of money, and I think he can do a lot of damage to Romney if he chooses to through advertising, because I don't really think Romney's a good fit for the Republican electorate, and I think that Perry is a much better fit. And if Perry wants to really savage Romney over his many vulnerabilities with that voting group, I think he can gain a lot of that traction back that he's lost. So I wouldn't dismiss him yet. But I think in terms of the general election that Obama's in deep, deep trouble, and particularly if Romney is the nominee, it's very hard for me to see how Obama wins a second term.
Aaron is next in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Good.
My question is that I hear your guest saying that members of Congress are more so being controlled or bribed or, as he quoted, being owned. And I'm just wondering, what are some examples on, you know, of that happening on a day-to-day basis, and how is it that our current government, I mean, I'm imagining, is supposed to protect against something like that happening, because that's, from my understanding, that's not a very democratic way of operating. And furthermore, If that is happening, why isn't that something that is being covered by the media more? Why isn't this something that people are more concerned about?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for the last question, except that, you know, most media, present company excepted, most media are corporate media, and they probably at base don't have much of an incentive to report the facts about the way the system works. In terms of why the government is allowing this to happen, I'm sort of working backwards through these questions. You know, now you're talking about the fox who's guarding the hen house. So if you're looking for the fox to solve the problem of the fox, I think you can probably forget about that for obvious reasons. And in terms of examples, I mean, I think personally, this is the most crucial question in American politics. It's the question of campaign finance reform, which generally makes people's eyes roll back in their head through boredom. And I understand that completely. And I'm sometimes one of those people. But it is the key, I believe, that unlocks all the other doors of policymaking in America. If you want to understand gun policy, if you want to understand drug policy, if you want to understand defense policy, if you want to understand environmental policy, if you want to understand healthcare policy, and on and on and on, and all the ways that we get all those things wrong, you have to understand the fact that the people in Washington who make those policies are not sitting down at their desk and thinking, I wonder what's good for the American people. What they're doing is they're being told how to vote by the people who put them in office, and they're obliging those people because it's a nice little quid pro quo for them. And Abramoff talked about it on 60 Minutes last night. I imagine you can YouTube that segment if you happen to miss it. But he talked about how they offered existing congressional staffers jobs, very lucrative jobs, in his lobbying firm once they left Congress. And once they did that, they immediately owned those people. And he gave examples of how you could slip items of legislation into a bill, maybe a single line, for example, that took care of the benefactors who hired the lobbying firm to get that done. Nobody even noticed it. And lo and behold, policy was made once again supporting the interests of the plutocrats and dismantling the interests of the American public. Because after all, even if it's not harmful to the public, which it often is, the public pays for those things. The public pays for those subsidies. The public pays for those failures to regulate, as we're paying right now in terms of the economic crisis that we're in.
Let's spend just a moment, because I think we're already seeing the effects of the Supreme Court decision concerning the amount of money that outside groups can pour into elections. And I think it's going to be phenomenal this year. We in Wisconsin are already seeing a huge number of ads from Americans for Prosperity on, as you know, Wisconsin is in a state of upheaval. And we're seeing a number of ads really touting how great the current administration is, and we're not in a recall yet. We don't know if there will be a recall. They're just ads that are there all the time. And I'm wondering about the effect of that Supreme Court decision on all kinds of races in this country. Obviously, whoever has the most money and is better organized will dominate the airwaves.
I think that is obvious, Kathleen. And, you know, the only way I can give you an answer to this question is to say that the system was fundamentally and disastrously broken before Citizens United, and now it's going to be exponentially worse. I mean, that just simply opened the floodgates and knocked down whatever, you know, sort of tenuous barriers had existed to an already dramatically corrupted system. And people just have to ask themselves, you know, a fundamental question: Do you want policymakers to be acting on behalf of the public interest or the special interest? And do you really believe? I mean, if you talk to people, it's quite fascinating at a certain level and highly insulting at another level. But if you ask members of Congress, you know, look, you get all this money in order to win elections, and you want to tell us that that doesn't influence your voting, and they'll all say, no, it doesn't. Some of them will say, well, what that money gives is access. So if you give me a bunch of money, then you can have a meeting with me. If you don't give me a bunch of money, you don't get the meeting. So my response to that is twofold. Number one, what's democratic about that concept, if you just even accept that at face value, that I have to buy access to my representative in Washington? And number two, that it's ludicrous to believe that. I mean, that's a complete insult to my intelligence to ask me to believe that all you buy with that money is access. And we have a number of testimonials, Jack Abramoff being just the latest, that explain explicitly that that's not the case. You get a lot more than access. You get legislation. You get regulation or deregulation. You get policy.
Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I listened to your guest for about 5 minutes and had to call in because this is so refreshing. I agree with him 100%, and it isn't a Republican, and it isn't a Democratic issue, and you're still getting calls from people that are saying, see, this is what the Republicans did, or see, this is what the Democrats did, and it isn't that. It's really all economics. It's all money. And until the money comes out of the system, it's not going to work. And my question is, you know, rather than say write to your senator or your congressman, I don't know what to do about it. I've been a libertarian for the last 20 years. Not that I agree with him 100%, but I just had to be something different than a Republican and a Democrat.
Well, I thank the caller for those comments. You know, in terms of what to do, I've not usually been a believer in the viability of third parties in America. I mean, the institutional roadblocks to third party succeeding are enormous, and that's why, of course, we have not seen the rise of a successful third party since Lincoln and the Republicans. However, I think the time is perhaps more ripe for that possibility now than it's been in my lifetime because, you know, the sentiment in the public with respect to either of the two existing prominent parties is as low as it's ever been, and for a very good reason. And so that's a possibility. But I think the more likely scenario has always been to essentially do to the Democratic Party what the far right has done actually a couple times now, maybe three times in the last 30 years, to the Republican Party. And that is basically for movement people to move in and hijack the party and pull it away from the mainstream or pull it away from its status quo. So I think you had that with the Reagan Revolution. I think you had that again kind of with the Newt Gingrich wave and now a third time with the Tea Partier folks. And in every instance, the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right. So I think if there's much hope of progressive electoral politics succeeding, you're going to have to do the same thing within the context of the Democratic Party. The existing Democratic Party, I'm glad the caller mentioned, you know, the difference between the two parties. The existing Democratic Party, I think, in some ways is as bad as the Republicans with respect to the things that I've been talking about this hour, and in many ways worse. And the reason I say that is because they trade off of a different rhetoric, a different narrative that they are the party of the people, and they trade off a history of FDR and the New Deal and Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. And that's a, you know, somebody, one of your earlier callers used the term betrayal. I think that's a far greater betrayal. And I particularly believe that Bill Clinton especially, and to almost the same extent Barack Obama, have betrayed the Democratic Party, betrayed the ideals of Roosevelt and the New Deal, betrayed liberalism, betrayed the American people, and have been very successful in destroying the prospects of the Democratic Party.
Let's talk about Elizabeth Warren for a moment, because she's really catching on in Massachusetts, and I have a couple questions. Why is it that the party hasn't been able to gather more people like her, because there have to be a lot of people who kind of agree with her philosophy about things. And I'm wondering, is it realistic to think that that philosophy could win seats? Because a lot of people were saying with Obama, you know, he had to govern more from the center. That's where the country is. It's not to the left. It's not to the right. I guess I'm asking a couple questions here. One is, do you think that candidates like Warren would be very popular in this country? Why aren't there more of them? Or is she too liberal?
I don't think she's too liberal, particularly in the context of Massachusetts. I think particularly as the national context changes, you'll see more candidates like her. Why there aren't more, I don't know. And why there, as you quoted from my article, Kathleen, why there isn't a more robust left under the conditions that we live under in America today is a real mystery to me, because it seems like that's precisely what there ought to be given those conditions. And one possible explanation is that the way the system is set up now, it's extremely daunting to run for political office in many ways. It's daunting in terms of the invasion of your personal privacy. It's daunting in terms of the effort required. It's daunting in terms of the way you have to beg for money constantly. It's daunting in respect to the amount of money you actually have to spend to do it. And so I'm sure many people don't run for that reason alone. And I think a lot of people don't run because they probably have a recognition, which is probably almost entirely true, that to succeed at all, you would have to essentially be bought off. You would have to be corrupted. And they don't want to go there. But that may change. We may see some more kind of guerrilla politics. And whether those kind of people can be elected or not, I think they absolutely can be. And I think in this context, you may see that start to happen. I think a more interesting question and a more difficult question, perhaps, I mean, that one is interesting and difficult enough. But what would happen if all of a sudden you had, a new, let's say it was 1933 again, and you had that Congress and that president in office with that agenda, what would happen in the context of a new globalized world that's very different in that respect from that era? And that concerns me more, and the mobility of capital in particular concerns me more. François Mitterrand tried to basically implement forms of socialism, or one might say enhanced socialism, in France all the way back in 1980, and he famously had to do what was described as the U-turn on his policies because of capital flight. Basically, the moneyed interest said, well, okay, if you're going to do that, we're out of here. And I would have a grave concern about that in the American context, but I think there are probably ways to deal with that. But, of course, as you pointed out, the first question is getting that form of government, and then you'd have to deal with the question of implementing those policies.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest for All Things Political today is Professor David Green, Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. And we always like to tell people about Wisconsin backgrounds. He did receive his Ph.D., and MA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He teaches, a lot of topics. He teaches in the subfields of comparative politics, international relations, American politics, and the list goes on. And we're talking politics this hour. Our phone number, Ralph, thanks for your call, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been extremely busy this morning, so you could use an email if you want to, and we hope we can get to you. And that's talk@WPR.org. Our number two of our program, nearly 16 million Americans will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia by 2050. The program that we're going to talk about is Time Slips, a drug-free creative storytelling intervention which improves communication skills. And it's really interesting. And we'll be speaking with somebody who uses the program at a nursing facility in the Milwaukee area. We will also be speaking with the founder and director of the program, who's written Forget Memory, Creating Better Lives for People with Dementia. She is the director of the UWM Center on Age and Community and associate professor of theater at the Peck School of the Arts at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So it should be a really interesting hour, as we hope you're finding this one to be. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Chuck in Stevens Point. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. I really enjoyed the show this morning. I agree with your guest's economic analysis, and I'm wondering, I do have some hope in Occupy Wall Street, and I'm hoping that might lead toward, you know, perhaps pushing the Democrats in a more positive direction. I think that direction, as your guest said, would be real political finance reform. The old saw, we have best politicians money can buy, I think has never been truer. If we went to a simple idea like, you know, one person, one vote, $1, one vote, meaning individual campaign limits. You can only contribute to campaigns on an individual basis, and there'd be some limit. I don't care if it's $200 or $2,000. And you can only contribute to politicians that you can actually vote for, which keeps that out-of-district and out-of-state and out-of-country contribution going to our politicians. And that would also be coupled with some reform of political advertising, meaning we could have political debate on our public airwaves, whether they be Wisconsin Public Radio, where we do have this debate, or on corporately owned media, because, you know, we the people do own the airwaves and license these people. Why not have free, real political debate that isn't paid for by contributions? I'd like your guest to answer.
Thanks. Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. I think your ideas are good ones, but I would go further. I basically would like to get private money out of politics entirely and have political campaigns be publicly funded. It's by far and away the best investment Americans could make. The tax dollar that they would spend on, you know, funding a campaign system for the expression of ideas and candidates would save them hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars on what would otherwise be misspent monies by Congresses that were privately bought. So I would certainly go that way. I certainly believe that that media outlets, particularly electronic media outlets, which benefit from being awarded use of publicly held airwaves, should be compelled to give up some, you know, moderate sliver of time during campaign cycles in order to present information from candidates. It gets a little trickier when you start asking the question, well, what do you do about individual third-party actors who want to express opinions? You have legitimate, I think, First Amendment questions there. But what we've done to some extent in this country and what other countries have done successfully is to basically say, you know, none of that is permitted, at least on television and radio, let's say, for 30 days or 60 days before an election cycle. You can do whatever you want to do other times, but during that time, you know, you can't have a flood of private money from the Koch brothers or unions or whomever. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit tricky, but it's not really that tricky, and the benefits of radically redesigning our system would be enormous. I think they would solve so many of our problems. And the fundamental way in which that's true is that, you know, as I stated over, sorry to be redundant on this, but what you really want in a real democracy is for policymakers to be sitting down and saying, what's in the public interest when they decide how
sure,
to cast their
that
vote?
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but I mean, how radical is that?
It's not radical. It's not radical at all. But, you know, when you were describing what you would like, I'm thinking the whole time, David, we're at exactly the opposite extreme. We're just, the money's pouring in, you know, it's quite different. It's going to take a long time to get to where you want to be.
Oh, it's worse than ever, and we're headed, you know, way off the cliff in the wrong direction. So now, increasingly, state politics and judicial politics are subject to the influence of money. Increasingly, you have members of state Supreme Courts who mm-hmm. have to campaign for those positions, and then they're beholden to the people who pay for their campaigns. I mean, imagine that. Could you imagine being a litigant in court and the other side that you're opposing contributed to the campaign of the judge? I mean, does anybody think that you'd get fair justice in that context? Well, the exact same thing is true of legislation. Do you really think you're getting fairly decided legislation if somebody is contributing to the legislator? We just have to, you know, and maybe, Kathleen,
right.
It's good that
but
we're going completely
distance,
off the cliff here because, you know, maybe it's, you know, like somebody with a substance abuse problem. We
so
just have to hit rock bottom and recognize how bad it is, and then we can, and only then we can have a radical revision of our system.
Less than a minute left. Sonia from Thermopolis, Wyoming. Hi, Sonia.
Hello. Has David considered the fact that, you know, everybody's betrayed by Obama, but that maybe he went into the office with good intentions and
was
sat down by the powers that be, that is not our government, and was told this is the way the game is played, and if you don't play our game, you may not survive your presidency.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a theory that a lot of people have kicked around sort of half in jest and half not. I don't know if that's the case. I mean, if you look at Obama's campaign carefully, and he himself has said this, he said, you know, somehow people manage to project onto me whatever they want from me. And that could be very different things from very different people. So if you look at his campaign, he wasn't very clear very often about particular policies that he would adopt, but he was pretty clear in terms of highly lofty rhetoric about, you know, serious substantial change. And he's not delivered on that. And I don't know. I mean, I'm at a very great distance. It's hard to say. I think there's some psychological stuff going on there. I think Obama's a guy who just really likes to be liked and wants everybody to get along.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to you. We're plumb out of time. No, no, you know, don't be sorry. Thank you for the hour. It was great. Thanks.
My pleasure. It was really fun, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Professor David Green, Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for your calls, everybody. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. We'll return following the news.